Hello, folks. Welcome to the LRIS podcast series. My name is Will Aitchison, and today we're going to talk about the coronavirus. Say, I've been thinking of holding on to this podcast until our usual first Thursday podcast, which comes out first Thursday of every month, but so much has been happening. There have been so many developments around the country that I wanted to get you this interim update on labor and employment issues that deal with the coronavirus. I fully expect that when 2 weeks comes around and we're doing our regular first Thursday podcast, we are probably going to do exactly the same thing, and a ton will have changed between now and then. And so much has changed for all of us, right? Our lives are fundamentally different. In Oregon this morning, the governor shut down the state, much like Illinois or California or an increasing number of states that are out there. We have seen the work life of public safety employees fundamentally altered in a way that we have never seen before, really, even in the wake of 9/11. We didn't see this degree of changes. And we have legislation that is coming in at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level that impacts the labor and employment rights of employees and employers. We're not yet, of course, seeing any court cases, but they'll come. They'll be down the road. And we see employers taking all sorts of measures to cope with not just the present effects of the virus, but because of the trajectory of this virus, what the future effects are going to be a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks from now, when things we are being told are going to get really, really bad. So with that, let's dive into the labor and employment issues that we're hearing about here at LRIS. You may have others. If you do, please let us know. Send us an email at info@lris.com. I would love to be able to make this at least one clearinghouse where people can go to and get up-to-date information on what's going on with labor and employment issues and the coronavirus. Okay, so what are we seeing? First of all, let's talk about bargaining issues. And there are a ton. We have employers wanting to make unilateral changes in all sorts of things and to make them now, not to give any advance notice, but to make the changes before the end of the day or by the next day or whatever it might be. What are we seeing being changed out there? Well, on the law enforcement side, we are seeing changes in shift lengths. There's a lot of interest nationally in moving employees to 12-hour shifts, some version of a 12-hour shift. And when I say some version, they can be anything from two on, two off, three on, three off. Some folks are doing two on, three off, two on, three off, or three on, three off, whatever. There's so many different configurations for a 12-hour shift. One thing you need to remember about a 12-hour shift is it causes a greater amount of work than a regular 40-hour work week. A 12-hour shift produces somewhere around, depending on how you count, 2,190 hours of work per year, where a 40-hour work week produces, if you want to be absolutely precise, 2,086 hours and some change in hours per year. So you have roughly 100 to 110 additional hours of work that are generated by a 12-hour shift. What do you do with those? Well, we don't know what people are going to do with them in the time of coronavirus, but we do know what they've done with them historically with 12-hour shifts. Some folks have simply ignored them. They just simply go to the 12-hour shift. The 12-hour shift can fit under the Section 7K exemption under the FLSA, assuming you configure it correctly. They just simply accept the fact that you're going to have 110 hours additional work on a 12-hour shift. Employers love that, of course. Employees, from their standpoint, the ones who have accepted this, view the benefits of the 12-hour shift as compensating for those additional hours. That's not the way most people have done it, though. Most people have gone to some sort of system that balances out the hours over time. And the two most common are some folks will work an 8-hour shift into the 12-hour schedule, do so every couple of weeks. That works to balance out the 12-hour shift. Others will simply give an adjusting amount of compensatory time off somewhere down the road so that in the end, the employees work 2,086 or 88 or 80, whatever, however you're counting, hours per year. And it's very common to see a 12-hour shift configuration where employees get an additional 96 hours or 110 hours of comp time that they can use over the course of the year. That's the way people have done it historically. What are the advantages of a 12-hour shift in a crisis time like this? Well, there are several of them. First of all, when you're dealing with an infectious disease, you have employees who are showing up in cohorts. So theoretically, they could only infect people who are working on the same shift. And so there's somewhat of a limitation to the transmission of the disease. A second benefit, quite apart from the disease element of it, is from an employer's standpoint, employees have typically fewer breaks on a 12-hour shift. Not so much fewer breaks as fewer break minutes per day, so they're available for work more. Also, from both the standpoint of an employer and an employee, this cohort notion gives you continuity of supervision that you frequently don't have with an 8 or a 10 or an 11 or a 9-hour shift or whatever else might be out there. There's a bunch of different advantages to a 12-hour shift. Disadvantage, of course, is you get tired on a 12-hour shift, and the long-term studies aren't very optimistic about the health implications of a 12-hour shift on employees, particularly long-term 12-hour shifts. We are also seeing changes in shifts in the fire service, less so because the majority of firefighters are already on the ideal shift for such a situation, which is a 24-hour shift. But there are some firefighters, most prominently the Fire Department of New York, who are not on 24-hour shifts who have now moved to 24-hour shifts. There is also talk in New York about moving EMS personnel who are not in the fire department there. There's a separate department moving EMS personnel to a 24-hour shift. We don't know that yet. So that's the first of the big changes we see employers wanting to make, changes in shift lengths. Very similarly, same category, really, changes in days off configurations, some canceled days off that we're seeing, changes in work schedules apart from going to the 12-hour shift. We see some going to 10s and the like. The fourth of the changes is whether an employer can force employees who are symptomatic to go home. Fifth, very relatedly, can an employer force employees whose family members are symptomatic to go home? Very similarly, can an employer force employees who have been exposed to coronavirus, either by virtue of travel or by virtue of actual exposure with someone who tests positive for the disease, whether they can force those individuals to go home? Seventh, we've seen some employers wanting to make changes in their sick leave policies, the circumstances under which sick leave can be used. Eighth, there are some employers, particularly this is true, it seems to be on the East Coast, who are simply shutting down secondary employment opportunities, including canceling all secondary employment. Ninth, we're seeing a bunch of departments, most prominently here, LAPD, where detectives are being assigned to patrol duties, or an interim step we're seeing whether detectives can be required to report to work in uniform rather than plain clothes in the event they're needed for patrol functions. And then lastly, 10th, we are seeing staffing changes, particularly moving away from, or in some cases, moving towards two-person cars in law enforcement. So what are the general rules about these sorts of unilateral changes? What can you expect to see a court or a labor board or an arbitrator look at to decide whether or not an employer has the right to make these changes? And it's very much a triaging sort of effect, I think, that you're going to see. First of all, does the contract or the memorandum of understanding, if you're in a state that has MOUs instead of collective bargaining agreements, does the contract have an emergency or force majeure clause that covers the issue? Force majeure basically kind of means act of God. Think of it kind of like that. So does the contract say something about whether the employer can act unilaterally under some circumstances? And would these circumstances fit? So that's obviously the first place you turn with any unilateral change issue is you ask, does the contract control this thing? And some do, most don't. Most collective bargaining agreements don't have emergency clauses, and it's very rare to see force majeure clauses. I can, by the way, go on mispronouncing force majeure for the rest of this podcast, and I will, so wait for it. So you don't see too many contracts with those clauses, so that gets us into our secondary level of analysis. Let's assume the contract doesn't cover the issue. Secondly, is there a provision in state law that allows employers to act unilaterally in a particular area in the event of an emergency? So there are some state laws where basically the employer's allowed to fundamentally disregard a collective bargaining agreement if an emergency is declared. Florida, I think, is the most prominent example of that. There are other state collective bargaining laws that allow some unilateral changes. California, I think, is probably the most prominent example of this. There's an emergency clause in the California State Collective Bargaining Law. There it's called the Meyer-Milius-Brown Act, or MMBA. There's an emergency clause that allows an employer to act unilaterally to make changes that aren't specified in the collective bargaining agreement. Doesn't allow the employer to violate the specific clause that's in the contract, but allows the employer to change things that are not specifically referenced in the clause. The MMBA California law requires pre-change notice to unions of the change and post-change, post-implementation bargaining. And that, I think, is going to be where you see these emergency clauses in collective bargaining agreements, in state laws. That's going to be the predominant form of the emergency clause, is something like that. Pre-change notice, post-change bargaining, and an employer's going to be allowed flexibility to make changes in things that aren't in the collective bargaining agreement. The National Labor Relations Act has an emergency exception. It's thought of as being, though, an economic exigency exception. It's not a broad-based emergency exception. So it's not quite clear what state labor boards, state and local labor boards are going to do with case law under the National Labor Relations Act. We've got to see. Okay, so that's secondary level of analysis. But what if your contract doesn't control the issue? What if there isn't a provision in state law that allows an employer to act unilaterally? Where do we next turn? What's the next question we ask? Next question we ask is, has the local labor board, your state labor board, or if you bargain under a local ordinance, your local labor board, has the labor board created such an exception by case law? Some have. Most haven't, but you have to check that out. Then level of analysis four, let's assume the contract doesn't control. Let's assume there's nothing in state law, either by virtue of the statute itself or by virtue of fiat from the labor board, nothing in state law that waives the the union's ability to bargain over unilateral changes and mandatory subjects of bargaining. Then, to the extent that the topic, whatever the topic is mandatorily negotiable, the employer's going to have to bargain before it makes the change. It's going to have to negotiate about both the decision and any mandatorily negotiable effects of the decision. It could well be that somewhere down the road, we see labor boards creating a COVID-19 exception to this notion of bargaining. I do suspect that we're not going to see unions pitching a big fuss about this because they're in the middle of the emergency just the way everybody else is. We all know that. But I will say that from a technical legal standpoint, absent any right given in the contract to make emergency unilateral changes and mandatory subjects of bargaining, absent any such authority under state law, an employer technically has to bargain about these changes before implementing them. So now let's go back to our list of 10 issues. The 10 issues that I've indicated we're seeing employers wanting to make changes in, are these mandatory subjects of bargaining? Shift length, sure, obviously, right? It's an hours of work issue. Days off, same answer. Work schedules, same answer. Sick leave policies, I ticked off 4 different sick leave policies. Same answer, it's an hours of work issue. Secondary employment opportunities. Almost every state thinks secondary employment is mandatory for bargaining. Whether detectives can be assigned to patrol duties. I think a substantial change in the duties of detectives very likely to be negotiable. And then lastly, what about staffing, particularly in the police setting, going from or to two-person cars? Most states would find that not to be a mandatory subject of bargaining, but would find the effects of that to be negotiable, particularly if you're going to two-person cars, the effects in terms of the potential for disease transmission between the officer and the officer's partner. So there we have it. That's kind of the first one that we are seeing. We are seeing employers wanting to make changes in mandatory subjects of bargaining and to do so quickly. Next up, a panoply of sick leave issues, some of which are intertwined with workers' compensation issues. And I like phrasing these things as questions. We sent an email around this morning, by the way. If you're not on our email list, do send a message in to info@lras.com. We sent an email with some of what I'm talking about around. And I phrased many of these issues in terms of questions, and I think it really works pretty well. So first sick leave question. If an employee has to be quarantined because of COVID-19 exposure or travel, may or must the employee use sick leave to cover the absence? So what's going on out there on this issue? Well, of course, if an employee has to be quarantined because of COVID-19 exposure, that would seem to be a perfect use of sick leave under a collective bargaining agreement or under an employer's personnel practice. That would seem to be obvious. But from the employee's standpoint, understand that the employee isn't actually sick. And if you put them in the position where they are forced to use to draw down their sick leave in order to account for their absence during what may be a 2-week quarantine period, you're going to find some employees who may be reluctant to stay home, who the employer wants to stay home. And so what we are seeing out there, and again, there's no cases on any of this stuff yet, okay? But what we are seeing out there is employers moving to putting employees on some form of administrative leave with pay when the employee is being quarantined because of COVID-19 exposure or where the employee has traveled. Now, I said some sort of administrative leave with pay. Some places are actually calling it administrative leave with pay. Some are calling it special sick leave. I've actually seen it referred to as coronavirus sick leave. In some cases, the amount of this paid time off, think of it just as paid time off where the employee isn't drawing down from one of her or his paid time off accounts like sick leave or vacation. In some places, the amount of this paid time off is capped very commonly at 2 weeks at 80 hours. Some places, we posted on our website today a policy in Clackamas County, Oregon. Clackamas County is a suburban Portland county. It's a metropolitan county, has a very large law enforcement function. And Clackamas County, the length of the time is unlimited. The specials paid sick leave is unlimited. And then we're finding some employers taking the position that employees are just going to have to burn up their own leave. That's the minority from what I have heard. That seems to be fairly rare. Most employers are really stepping up to the plate here and saying, you know, it's just the right thing to do for employees to get a special form of paid time off, whatever you call it, administrative leave with pay, coronavirus sick leave, special sick leave, whatever you call it. Under these circumstances, employees should not be burning down their leave accounts. Second question. If a first responder contracts COVID-19 in the course of performing their duties, is treatment for that and the wage loss associated with it covered by workers' compensation? Boy, do I wish I had a good answer for you here, but I don't. It comes down to a state-by-state analysis of what your workers' compensation law looks like. And here's why I say that. Some workers' compensation statutes and pension statutes distinguish between injury claims and illness claims. Injury claims, they're pretty obvious, right, as to whether or not the claim was incurred on the job. Illness claims, tougher to tell whether or not you came down with an illness because of an on-the-job exposure. And so there are some states that take the position that in order for a disease claim, an illness claim, to be compensable under the workers' compensation law, the employee's risk of contracting the disease must be higher and of a different nature than the public's risk. That, for example, is the approach that's used in Ohio and many other states, not just Ohio. Under that sort of test, is a first responder's risk of contracting the disease higher than the general public? Or would the first responder contract the disease in a different manner than the general public? It's not going to be a slam dunk, okay? I don't want to say it's going to be a mountainous burden of proof, but that is not going to be a slam dunk for public safety employees under that standard. So you're going to have to check and see whether or not a standard like that is out there to find out what the default is. What's the default as to whether workers' comp is going to cover employees who contract COVID-19 in the course of performing their jobs. Now, we already see activity from three other fronts, that change the playing field a little bit on this. And the first is, we are seeing some employers just simply, again, step up to the plate here and say, you know what our position is? Our position is that if we have a public safety employee who comes down with COVID-19, that is going to be presumed to be caused by the job. We're going to treat this as a presumptive causation condition. The second area we're seeing some sort of modification of this is we are starting to see some workers' compensation entities step up to the plate themselves and say, we're going to treat COVID-19 as a presumptive causation condition. And the best example I can give to you is something that was done on March 18th by the director of Michigan's Workers' Disability Compensation Agency. I'll post a link to it on our website, or Mark Fuller of LRIS will post the link, to be completely honest there. What Michigan did was to adopt emergency rules that apply to first response employees who are exposed to COVID-19. What do those rules say? It's simple. It's one sentence long. I'll read it to you. A first response employee suffers a personal injury that arises out of and in the course of employment if the employee meets one of the following criteria. And then there's four that are listed. What are they? One, is quarantined at the direction of the employer due to confirmed or suspected COVID-19 exposure. Two, receives a COVID-19 diagnosis from a physician. Three, receives a presumptive positive COVID-19 test. Or four, and it's an or, it's not an and, receives a laboratory confirmed COVID-19 diagnosis. And yes, I did say number one, that the simple quarantining of the employee at the direction of the employer is going to be treated as a compensable work injury in Michigan. So that's the second area. And I know that this sort of move is being considered by pension boards, workers' compensation boards elsewhere in the country. The third thing that we're seeing is we are seeing unions try to convince state legislatures to enact presumptive causation laws that would list COVID-19 right alongside lung conditions and heart disease and the like. So far, not much is happening on that front. Not for the least of reasons is that most state legislatures simply aren't in session. And this may be something that's going to be done after the fact. There was a fourth effort, which I kind of put in the nice try department. The National Fraternal Order of Police petitioned the Labor Secretary Scalia, to have COVID-19 covered by presumptive causation laws. I'll send you a link to the letter we'll post a link to the letter that the FOP sent. From my standpoint, that really falls under the nice try department because the labor secretary doesn't really have the ability to designate anything as COVID-19 or as a presumptive causation condition because the labor secretary doesn't deal with workers' compensation issues, much less worker compensation issues at the state and local level. So far, I haven't seen that Secretary Scalia has answered the FOP's petition, but it's worth looking at to see what he has to say. All right, next up, FMLA and other family-related issues. We've got a bunch of these out there. First question, if an employee is off work on approved FMLA leave, say it is child bonding leave after a child has been born, can the employer recall the employee from approved FMLA leave? And this one, I've talked to a bunch of lawyers about this, both on management and labor side. And you know what all of us high-priced lawyers, or some high-priced, some lower-priced lawyers have to say? We don't know. What we can tell you is there are no emergency provisions in the FMLA leave or FMLA statute that allow an employer to recall someone from approved FMLA leave. If an employer tries to do it from the standpoint of the union and the employee, what should the union and the employee do? Go back to work, the employee should, right? You don't want to test whether or not the employer is right or wrong by potentially brooking an insubordination claim. The employee should go back to work. This is the classic work now, grieve later, or work now, sue later issue. What will courts eventually do with this? We don't know. We don't have any idea. There is no emergency exception. Congress could have written one in. It didn't do it. So it may well be that the employer is going to be found to be in technical violation of the FMLA. But if I'm an employer, do I just simply act unilaterally in this area, assuming I've met my bargaining obligation, that is? I don't know. I'd have to think twice about it. I will say that. Okay, next up. If a first responder is exposed on the job to someone who is diagnosed with COVID-19, whether it's a fellow employee, whether it's a citizen, will the employer provide quarantine facilities? For example, one of those thousands of empty hotel rooms out there, to minimize the risk of spreading any infection to the employee's family. And I'm going to make it even more difficult here, because this is a question I got. What if a member of the employee's family has a compromised immune system? Well, we can say, number one, I think, there's nothing in the law that compels an employer to go out and provide a quarantine facility for employees under these circumstances. That's pretty clear. Number two, the employer side lawyers that I've talked to have said, look, it's the human thing to do. We should be doing it. However, we don't want to set a past practice where every time we have an employee who is exposed to a contagious disease, we're putting them up in a hotel. So what we're suggesting to our clients, and I've heard this from more than one management side lawyer, is, look, if you're going to find quarantine facilities for employees in this situation, make sure you have an agreement with the union that it is non-precedent setting for the future. What are employers actually doing out there with respect to this? I'm not getting a lot of reports in, but it is clear that at least some, and some very large employers, are picking up the cost for the hotel rooms. We will link on the webpage to an article in the Houston newspaper. The Houston Fire Department is providing hotel rooms for firefighters exposed to COVID-19. A related family issue, although not technically an FMLA issue, is how are first responders and their employers dealing with the heightened childcare issues that are posed not just by the closure of schools, but also by lengthened work shifts? And here, not seeing a lot of action by employers. There's no legal obligation, by the way, on the part of an employer to do anything here. But we are now kind of starting to see employers dip their big toes in the water as they are realizing the worst is yet to come with this pandemic. And so we have some employers that are offering free childcare for emergency workers, healthcare workers, and emergency responders. And we'll put a link on our webpage to an article that describes where you are seeing this sort of thing pop up. Next up, the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Not a lot yet, although it will be coming down the road. The big one, I think, will be coming down the road. So first question. And we're helped here a lot, by the way. And we're helped by the fact that the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, which administers the ADA, posted a series of questions and answers on its webpage, giving guidance to employers and employees last week. We will put a link on our website for the EEOC's post, and it's actually good. They did a pretty good job of coming up with an English language translation, something the EEOC isn't always known to be able to do. So All three questions, ADA questions that I have heard so far about existing issues. There's a fourth question that we haven't quite gotten to yet, maybe the big one. But all three questions the EEOC has weighed in on. And I think with respect to all of these, the EEOC, EEOC's guidance is likely to be followed by the courts. So what's the ADA issue here? Is the ADA issue is that when you have employees who either have COVID-19 or have symptoms that are consistent with those of COVID-19, they have a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that causes all sorts of things to be triggered. Most prominently, the privacy rights of the ADA. The privacy provision of the ADA says that an employer cannot obtain information about the nature or extent of a disability unless it has reasons for doing so that are both job-related and consistent with business necessity. So when you have an employer that's looking at an employee who is coughing, the employer has to be careful in terms of what the employer asks the employee to make sure that the ADA isn't being triggered. And the EEOC here has drawn, I think, some pretty good common sense lines in terms of how it's answering these sorts of questions. Okay, question number one. Can the employer take employee temperatures? And the EEOC says yes. This is happening now. It's happening in I think most correctional facilities around the country, but I've heard of it happening in fire and law enforcement as well. The EEOC says that is a reasonable measure for the employer to take. Question number two, can the employer ask employees if they are suffering from symptoms that are common with COVID-19? And so what are the major symptoms? Major symptoms seem to be three that are predominant, a fever, a cough, particularly a persistent dry cough, and then lastly, a general feeling of malaise, aches, and you just simply don't want to move. Those are the three predominant symptoms. So can the employer ask employees if they're suffering from those symptoms? And the EEOC says, yes, the employer can ask that. And third, does the ADA allow the employer to require the employee to stay home if they have symptoms consistent with COVID-19? Here, the EEOC is looking at whether or not that would be discriminating against somebody who has a disability. And the EEOC has said under pandemic conditions, the answer to that question is yes. The EEOC, of course, isn't saying, what about the pay status of the employee? We have talked about that already. The EEOC is just answering the question of whether the ADA poses a bar to an employer forcing an employee to stay home. And the EEOC is answering that question. No, the ADA does not pose a bar to that. So what's the big question, the lingering fourth question that you're going to see? We're going to come up with a vaccine for this, right? We've got all sorts of companies that are working on it. There are some, we seem to be skipping right over the usual FDA approval process for vaccines, or at least greatly compressing them. And so it looks like sometime in the future, we are going to have a vaccine. What's that time frame? The best guesses I hear, and you know, like probably all of you, I am just sated with coronavirus information. I'm listening to podcasts and reading technical and non-technical articles all the time now about this. The best guess seems to be the earliest when we will have a vaccine that is widespread is 12 months in the future. I'm not a doctor, so don't listen to anything I say. And as usual with these podcasts, don't rely on any legal advice I'm giving. You need to check with your lawyers on this. But that's what the doctors say, 12 months, maybe as long as 18 months. So we're going to come down the road, right? When we have a vaccine, will an employer be able to force public safety employees to get the vaccine. And early indications are on this, and I'm seeing this a little bit in what the EEOC said the other day. Early indications are yes, with one possible exception. And the possible exception is employees who have bona fide religious beliefs that vaccines are against the tenets of their religion. Going to be pretty hard to find many religions that fall in that category. Certainly, Christian Scientists would fall in that category. There are some fundamentalist religions that fall in that category as well. But most religions really don't care one way or the other about vaccines. And that's a dicey proposition, making that exception when you think about it. The employer would be able to make that exception, but wouldn't be forced to put usually an unvaccinated public safety employee out on the street. They might have to put them into the equivalent of a light duty job. But remember, there's this string of ADA case law that says an employer doesn't have to create a light duty job in a public safety agency. So it may well be that the net effect of the employee saying, my religion prevents me from getting a vaccine, it may well be that that means the employee has to be reasonably accommodated in some other job out there, a lower paying job. It's very early yet, right? We're a year from the vaccine, but it doesn't hurt to start thinking about that. All right, next up, OSHA issues. Are we seeing any OSHA issues out there? And the answer is, yeah, we've seen a whopper of an OSHA issue in New York City. NYPD and FDNY seem to be kind of the center point of an awful lot of these COVID-19 issues. The PBA, the Patrolman's Benevolent Association in New York City, filed a state-level OSHA complaint. I think this was about 10 days ago now, maybe 7 days ago, complaining that there weren't enough masks for patrol officers. And what really blew me away about the news story that I read on this was the employer's answer. And the employer's answer was, we've given a lot of officers, not all, given a lot of officers first-rate bacterial masks. And what blew me away about that is, do you know the size difference between a bacterium and a virus, particularly the COVID-19 virus? It's like the difference between a marble and, well, now I'm losing it on the other end of it. It's not like a marble and the earth, but there's a huge difference in size between these two things. And a mass that stops a fully grown bacterium is not going to stop a virus. So the employer's response there, I just didn't understand at all. I loved reading about this because public safety employees rarely use their state OSHA laws to file complaints. And I thought this was very creative and very appropriate use of the state OSHA system by the PBA in New York to raise the issue. What seems to have happened is while that complaint is still pending out there, the city of New York seems to have mobilized and gotten the masks out, appropriate masks out for police and fire, or at least I'm not reading any more articles about the PBA or the firefighters union protesting it. So we'll see. The AFL-CIO on the national level has asked Labor Secretary Scalia to establish OSHA standards for coronavirus exposure. So far, no answer. Would you be holding your breath if you were the AFL-CIO and you were asking the son of Antonin Scalia to weigh in on your side and establish coronavirus exposure standards? I wouldn't be, and I don't think they are. I think that was a public relations gesture more than anything else. Next up, tolling agreements. I'm almost done, by the way. So what are tolling agreements, and why should you be thinking about these? A tolling agreement puts on hold deadlines. It can even put on hold the running of a statute of limitations. And when you think about it, if you got a good-sized union or you've got a good-sized fractious relationship between the employer and the union, you're going to have a lot of different things percolating at different steps of different procedures. You may have some grievances, grievances that have yet to be filed, grievances that have been filed that are moving from step one to step two, grievances that are at arbitration, where you may have a hearing that is coming up, or you may have briefs that are due in the arbitration. You may have some unfair labor practice complaints where you've got all the same sorts of issues, time frame for filing, time frame for processing. You may have some civil service issues as well. You can make a pretty good argument that it benefits both an employer and a union right now to put all that stuff on hold. And it is possible to do it with a global tolling agreement. So this is one where you want to be thinking about it is, do we need to be approaching the other side, whether it's the union or management, approaching the other side and entering into such a global tolling agreement. I've written one for a client. I can't release it yet because it's not yet public. But I want to tell you, these don't have to be complicated. The one that I wrote, I had to stretch to get to two pages in order to accommodate the signature block. You know, sometimes you don't want to end a document on in the middle of the signature block. So these can be very simple. It just needs to say, basically, three things, I think, four things. First of all, what are you tolling? Make sure you list it. Secondly, how long is the agreement going to be in effect? The one that I drafted was 90 days. Third, is there an out? Can either side say, look, 45 days from now, we want out? I'd recommend that. I think that's a good idea. And fourth, you're probably going to want to talk about whether it applies to court proceedings, because they typically are a little bit more complicated. The tolling agreements for those are more complicated. The one I wrote dealt just with administrative proceedings and arbitrations and the like, so it was pretty easy. So think about a tolling agreement. All right, next up, vacations. Can pre-approved vacation leave be unilaterally revoked by the employer? Departments all over the country are considering this. Back to Los Angeles, LAPD has already done it, canceled vacation periods. How is this going to be analyzed? First of all, look at the contract. What does the contract say? And does it give the employer the right to cancel vacation under any circumstances? And does this fit within the circumstances that are allowable for cancellation? Most cases, the contract's going to be silent. Then it'll come down to, what's the past practice? Is there a past practice where, under these sorts of broad general circumstances, the employer has canceled vacations? Most of you can go right back to 9/11 and look at what occurred in the wake of 9/11 to find what those past practices are. In the absence of any clear past practice, I think the employer is going to be allowed to unilaterally cancel vacation time. May have to end up paying for the costs of any canceled travel, although most travel these days is actually being refunded by whoever the travel folks are. COVID-19 testing, there's an issue that's being raised by a bunch of unions out there that COVID-19 testing should be assigned as a priority for first responders. You can find almost all of the first responder unions in New York demanding that right now. We want those tests first, along with healthcare professionals. Oddly enough, the PBA in New York wasn't part of the letter that demanded more COVID-19 testing. Not sure what was going on there. And we are starting to see the first drive-through testing sites for COVID-19 around the country. And interestingly, the first that I have seen, like the one in Washington, for example, healthcare providers and first responders not only get priority, but they're the only people who can use them until all of them get the testing done. So we are starting to see this priority being given just simply as a matter of course. All right. A few other cleanup items that I want to talk about. We have listed a link on our webpage to the Centers for Disease Control's interim guidance on COVID-19 for all first responders. You probably want to take a look at that. It deals with mostly firefighters and EMS response. It's worth taking a look at. We will also give you some links to what I think of as procedural changes in the law enforcement function. There's a bunch of changes out there. Some law enforcement agencies are not responding to other than high-level calls, taking telephone reports where there used to be in-person reports, a lot of citations in lieu of arrest. We're even seeing law enforcement agencies stopping individuals who are wrongfully congregating in large groups. So you're seeing an awful lot of that. We're seeing a lot of changes in correctional facilities. We will post for you the changes in the Cook County, Illinois jail that I think are as detailed as any that I have seen out there. There's a big brouhaha about the combination of law enforcement and correctional facilities, either not arresting people for low-level crimes, property crimes, or if they are already in jail, those sorts of individuals, releasing them. We see some, not a lot, but some law enforcement unions protesting that. But those protests don't seem to have had any effect. You're seeing routinely now cite in lieu of arrest procedures going in place for low levels of crimes. And then the last one, and I think this falls under the heading of, you remember Michael Conrad, the gruff, kindly sergeant in Hill Street Blues? Remember how he ended all of his roll calls with the phrase, be careful out there? This one falls under that heading. Go figure, right? The FBI has indicated that it has concrete information that some white nationalist groups are trying to target law enforcement with COVID-19 infections. They're going to try to find a way to spread the virus, to transmit the virus to law enforcement officers. So if you're in law enforcement, make sure your agency is aware of that, aware of the FBI's information on that, and that you take appropriate action with response to it. All right, that's a long podcast, and look, I want to end the same way Michael Conrad ended. Everybody, be careful out there. This is Will Aitchison signing off.